My podcasts often deal with distressing situations which are not suitable for children and some adults, for that matter. Some of what I discuss may trigger uncomfortable emotions. If that does occur, please reach out to Lifeline, Beyond Blue, or any other support service or person you feel comfortable with. Please keep in mind that there's always two sides, sometimes more, to every story. My guests provide their recollection of an event or incident, sharing their thoughts and their emotions, but it's theirs. Not everybody will agree with them. I never want to tell any guest what to say or what not to say, so there will always be others that see it differently, and I understand that. Hello, I'm Narelle Fraser. I was a cop with Victoria Police for 27 years, 15 of those as a detective, having dealt with all types of crime, from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. I witnessed the effect crime has on those involved and became one of those victims myself in 2012 when I was diagnosed with PTSD. However, out of adversity comes other opportunities like this, my own podcast. I'm still pinching myself. Thanks for listening and coming with me as we explore the human side and impact of crime.
We always do treat the deceased with respect to the person that they once were, but now we're looking at the scientific object.
My guest today has practiced forensic pathology for over 25 years. Shelley Robertson's bio is incredibly impressive and actually makes my head spin. Shelley was at one stage a forensic pathologist with the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine, what we refer to as VIFM. And as a detective, sometimes we were tasked with conveying a body to VIFM where we were required to attend the autopsy, observing the intricate, incredible work that a forensic pathologist does to determine the cause of death. That was Shelley behind the glass screen, gowned from head to toe, delicately, sensitively dissecting the deceased to determine what happened, when it happened, and how it happened. Our job as detectives was to determine why it happened, where it happened, and by whom. Shelley is a member of so many professional organisations I could spend half of my podcast detailing, but it's her interest in fatal aviation accident investigations that caught my eye. She completed a postgraduate diploma in aviation medicine and a master's degree in health sciences, aviation medicine, from the University of Otago in New Zealand, and she's been awarded a fellowship of the Australasian College of Aerospace Medicine. And she's also got a law degree. See what I mean about your head spinning? She's currently an honorary senior fellow, Department of Pathology, University of Melbourne, and now runs ForensAir, a forensic and aviation pathology consulting business providing expert medical legal opinion in matters of unnatural death, homicide, and aviation accidents. So I wonder what it feels like to conduct an autopsy. I wonder if Shelley ever felt affected during an autopsy. It's always impressed me how caring, considerate, and gentle the pathologist was. And they treated the deceased in the same way that they would somebody who was living. Shelley and her forensic pathologist colleagues must be very good, in fact, exceptional, at compartmentalising their day's work from their personal life. I wonder if there was an autopsy that she did, which she's never forgotten. Well, welcome, Shelley, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Narelle. Hi there.
Hi. Shelley, I don't know if you're aware, but my listeners probably are, but I don't have a TV and at home. So whenever I'm away and I have time to watch some TV, apart from watching rerun after rerun of my beloved Tigers, their numerous three, in fact, recent premierships, my next favourite program is Air Crash Investigators. And I was wondering, do you know of the show and what do you think of it?
Yes, I do know of this show. And, yes, it's very interesting. I watch them too.
Do you?
Yes.
I'm not sure what it is because they don't go into all the gore, really. It's more how they find out what happened is what interests me, and I suppose that's what you do.
Yes, well, I think the show highlights that how an accident investigation of that type goes about with getting people from all sorts of different fields and of expertise to give their opinions and put it all together and in that way work out what happened and why, and also prevent it happening again if possible.
Yeah, I bet. And so I wonder what it is, Shelley, about fatal aviation accidents that interested you more than, say, a fatal motor vehicle accident or a homicide. What was it about fatal aviation?
Well, I've always been interested in things aviation. My father was very keen on aeroplanes. He desperately wanted to become in the Australian Air Force, but was rejected because of a childhood problem with deafness, so he wasn't eligible to enlist. But we lived, as I was growing up, in the flight path of the then main Melbourne airport, Essendon. And I remember Dad taking me out on his shoulders to watch the big planes flying overhead, and that always fascinated me. So, I too have now joined the Royal Australian Air Force Specialist Reserve, and I'm very keen on all things aeroplane. So that led to my interest in aircraft accident investigation.
So could you share with us a fatal aviation accident that you're involved in and what we were able to find or not find?
Well, what, as a forensic pathologist, we're looking for is the cause of death, and if there were any factors affecting the pilot which may have caused or contributed to the accident. So we're looking, if you like, at the medical side of things. There are other experts, of course, for example, in the Australian Transport Safety Bureau that look at the aeroplane side of things, but we're mainly looking at the pilot. So the actual investigation is really not different to that looking for what went on in a murder investigation or any other sort of accident investigation. You're looking for what the cause of death was and things that might have contributed to the cause of death.
So what you're doing, Shelley, is instead of, if I got this right, instead of a victim of a homicide, your role in a fatal aviation accident is about the pilot or the people in the plane rather than the plane itself. Is there somebody else that examines the plane? That's not you. You are, yours is the pilot, et cetera. Is that right?
Yes,
the humans?
That's right. We do the humans. As I said, there's specialists in the Australian Transport Safety Board who look at the actual aircraft and the things like the cockpit voice recorders and all that sort of stuff. That's their job, but ours is to focus primarily on the pilot, but anyone else involved in the accident, and see if we can give them some information that helps put it all together.
So, would you say that is it more so human error? I was just going to say my question is it human error or mechanical often that is why an aviation accident occurs, but you wouldn't know about the mechanical side, would you? So I suppose I'm asking from a human being side, can you tell if they've made an error? No, I don't suppose you could you?
We can't, but we can sometimes say, for example, that things might have been affecting them. For example, if they've got severe heart disease or if they've been subjected to carbon monoxide poisoning or something like that, which may have caused the accident to occur.
Okay, righto. So Is there a fatal air crash that's really stumped you, where you've been unable to determine the cause?
It's not uncommon to find that the pilot has no significant natural disease. For example, our Civil Aviation Safety Authority has fairly strict guidelines for getting enabling pilots to get licenses. So if they've got severe medical conditions, they're not supposed to be flying anyway. So no, we don't usually see things like that. But I think over the years, I may have seen times when I thought something was present in the pilot, which may have contributed to the accident.
I suppose one of the main things you would always do, would it be to check, obviously, if he or she is drug affected or alcohol affected? That would be one of your first things you'd do, wouldn't it?
Yes, definitely.
So I might just ask that question I asked before in a different way. So in your experience, what is the main reason a fatal crash occurs? Do you believe it's human error or not human error, but due to a human doing something that was wrong, or they shouldn't have done it or whatever, or a mechanical error?
Oh, look, I'd really have to look at the statistics to say that, but I think probably in my experience there is something that you can find that may well have contributed to the pilot causing the accident. But then again, as we've previously said, I don't look at the bits of the aeroplane and see what else was going wrong or how that might have mattered.
Have you ever been in an aeroplane or flown an aeroplane yourself?
Yes, I started trying to get a flying license at one stage, but I had a student pilot license, but I found that it was something that you needed to really concentrate on, and due to my work and other commitments, I was really only able to devote about an hour a fortnight, and that's really not enough. You've got to fly a lot more and become very confident and know what you're doing. And I thought that it was perhaps best that I leave the flying to someone else. But I'm happy to sit in an aircraft, yes.
With all due respect, Shelley, if you've done an hour a fortnight, I don't think there's many people that would get in a plane with somebody that had done an hour a fortnight practice.
No, I certainly wouldn't either.
No. So apart from your interest in fatal aviation accidents, you've also been a forensic pathologist, as I mentioned before, conducting autopsies. I haven't attended all that many, but I do find them fascinating beyond words on so many levels. However, I must admit, when the stomach contents are expelled and examined, I have no reason or no understanding why, but that's the only time I've ever felt really ill during an autopsy, and it's happened every single time. Is there something about an autopsy when you get to a certain point in an autopsy where you feel just a little bit funny?
No. No, I don't think I can ever recall feeling a bit funny, no.
So what was it that interested you in becoming a forensic pathologist and dissecting a human body? Because it's not a career for the faint-hearted, is it?
No, but, as medical students, we worked on the dissection of a body as part of our anatomy training when we were very young. But when I finished my training in medicine and worked for a few years in hospitals as a doctor, I decided that I was becoming more interested in pathology, which is the sort of science of illness, and the scientific aspects were really attracting me. So I decided to specialise in pathology. So I did that for 5 or 6 years. And then just as I was finishing my pathology training, I heard about this new institute in forensic medicine being set up. And I thought, that sounds interesting. It's probably a bit more interesting than spending your life in the basement of a hospital staring down a microscope. So I went along and persuaded them to give me a job and worked there for 20 plus years, yes.
So can you take us into the world of a forensic pathologist and explain, if you can, why, when and how an autopsy is conducted, if you can take us through the process?
Yes, an autopsy is conducted when a death certificate can't be signed for whatever legal reasons by the treating doctor, or perhaps there is no treating doctor, or there is any other suspicious circumstances occurring, or anything else occurring, such as an accident or a suicide, something that is obviously not natural causes, and a death certificate can't be signed. Well, in that case, the case is referred to the coroner and then to the Forensic Institute for an autopsy or for an investigation into the cause of death, not necessarily an autopsy, especially in these days of computerized scanning, CT scanning, may not be needed to perform an autopsy, but that's the situation when an autopsy is necessary to obtain the cause of death.
And can you just take us through how you do an autopsy? Like, say, from when the moment the deceased is brought in, how is the deceased brought in? You know, let's say the police bring them in. Are they brought in on a table or a bed? Can you just take us from the start?
Well, that's, again, not certainly wasn't my part of the procedure. The bodies were admitted through the admissions area, and the bodies would be all the documentation gathered, and the bodies would be placed in the mortuary refrigeration area until it was decided if an autopsy was necessary and how that would be performed. Then if an autopsy was going to be performed, the body would be wheeled into the mortuary area. The clothes would have been removed, except in the case of homicides, where the clothes are left for the pathologist to remove in the presence of the police, and the police gather the evidence, as you know. But otherwise, the body is placed on a trolley and placed into the mortuary and onto a mortuary table where the dissection begins after an external examination, looking for any scars or bruises or anything else that needs to be documented, which might give clues as to what actually happened.
Can you tell us how you dissect the body?
The dissection is often carried out by the mortuary technician, or the initial dissection. The usually a large incision is made down the centre of the body, and the skin sort of peeled back so the abdominal and thoracic contents can be examined, usually by removing them from the actual body. But again, the technician does that.
And so if the technician does that, where is the pathologist?
Standing beside them.
Okay. And are you, as a pathologist, are you directing or are you asking questions? Like, what is your role if the role of the assistant is to actually do the opening of the skin and taking out the body parts?
Yes, we're standing there watching them and directing them to do something, or saying, hang on, that looks a bit strange, leave that alone, I'll have a look at that. And yes, very much directing it. Yep.
Okay. I must admit, I find as a detective, an incredibly, I don't know how to describe it, but I feel very privileged in a way to be at an autopsy. Privileged, I don't quite know how to explain it, but to see the care, number one, is I could, not that I think you'd throw the body around, but I just couldn't get over the care and just so kind and gentle. And I always found it incredible when, you know, you'd bring out a lung or you'd bring out a brain, and I'm thinking they are holding somebody's loved one's brain in their hand. Like, I just find that, I don't know what, privileged is the only word I can think of.
Yes, but that now is really a scientific object now. That it's not a person anymore. The person has gone and is no longer there. So now we're looking at the scientific remains, if you like. Yes, we always do treat the deceased with respect to the person that they once were, but now we're looking at the scientific object, and that also needs to be treated very cautiously, same as again any scientific objects, such that you're not destroying what science there is, or contaminating, or making things even more difficult to interpret. So that's why, or that's the way in which we handle these things.
And see, that's exactly what I mean about, you are obviously very good at, or yeah, you would have to be able to compartmentalize what you are doing, that, and you just said then it's a scientific process. It is a job that you have to do, whereas I can't help but see the person. And that's why you're obviously very good at what you do and being able to put that aside, because I just can't help but see them as, yeah, as I said, as a person. But you don't see it like that, obviously.
No. As I said, the person has gone. We're now looking at the science.
Amazing. How many deceased people would be in those fridges that you're talking about when they come in through admissions? How many bodies are in a fridge at one time?
Oh, it varies enormously. Probably can be up to 20 to 50, but perhaps even more if there has been some sort of catastrophic event.
How many autopsies, or do I call them autopsies? Because I was just going to ask, how many would you do or could you do a day?
When I was working there, I usually only did two a day. Occasionally, if it was really necessary, do more, but generally only two a day.
Okay, so how long would a normal autopsy take?
A couple of hours.
Okay. I find it very interesting to be part of that autopsy as the police. We're behind the glass screen, and I find it interesting the talk between the mortuary assistant and yourself. And if you find something, you'll say, you'll talk to us behind the screen to say, oh, there's a, you know, a wound. It looks, and, you know, you'd give us the dimensions, etc. And we could actually ask you questions. I just found that to be involved that intimately, I suppose, I always found it incredible what you can tell us from what you're examining.
Yeah. But, I mean, again, that's what we're trained to do. But there are a lot of things that perhaps we can't tell too. We need to do other investigations, such as get the toxicology laboratory results and look at parts of the body that we've kept for microscopic examination, all those things, which is why an autopsy report to be finalised may take weeks rather than, you know, the 2 hours I said to perform the autopsy, but to compile the actual report takes a lot longer, not as in shows like CSI where the autopsy is all over, you know, in half an hour and they're clutching the report the next day. That
yeah,
doesn't
if only
happen.
They knew the if only they knew reality.
That's right, yes.
Actually, you were probably there when I was a detective, but I can remember the old days at Flinders Street, and you were actually in the room with the deceased. There was no glass partition. Do you remember those days? No glass partition.
Yes, yes. I started there.
Oh,
yes.
My goodness. That was, and I can always remember, I don't know if it was a joke, and you might be able to tell me, but I can remember as a trainee they took us in to show us how an autopsy's done, and we all actually stood around the body, and I always remember, even in the street now, I look at people, and if there is the certain description that I remember this young man that they did the autopsy when we went in to look as a trainee, I can still remember him like it was yesterday. And he was only about 25 and he'd had an appendicitis attack and he'd passed away. And I can always remember standing around. And, you know, a number of my colleagues were fainting. There was a couple being sick. And at one stage there was a couple of, they must have been assistants or something, but they were sort of down the back of the autopsy room and they opened their lunch and started eating sandwiches. I'll never forget that. Did you used to do that as a bit of fun, or was that really... you really actually had your lunch in the room?
No, we never ate in the mortuary. Even in those days, there were should have been quite strict occupational health and safety rules. But the problem with that old mortuary and having people standing around is really what you just described, with people passing out and throwing up that weren't used to it. And that's... why it was a much relief to move to the institute and have a mortuary with a proper viewing room where the people watching the autopsy don't have to actually come in. And if they do pass out, that can be dealt with a lot better than passing out on the floor of the mortuary.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose these days too, it can only be a good thing that we're separated with that glass, because I'm just thinking to myself, like, the transference of any sort of contact or I don't know, if somebody coughed or COVID, I mean, we're all become very susceptible or concerned about that. But when you think about what could be transferred, you know, when we're all standing around and we were literally almost on top of the body.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Have you ever conducted an autopsy which has affected you in any way?
I must say I have always been affected particularly by people just doing their jobs and getting killed in that scenario. For example, the police shootings, that always bothered me considerably, and also some of the Black Saturday fires, people brought in still clutching dogs, that sort of thing really did get to me. Mm. I must say.
But also, Shelley, you wouldn't be a normal human being if that didn't affect you, and I'm thinking if it didn't affect you, there's something wrong, isn't there?
Yes, I suppose so.
Yeah. So the police shootings, are you talking about the actual policemen that were brought in that you had to examine?
Yes.
Or people that police have shot?
No, the police themselves being shot.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there a particular type of autopsy that you dread or you'd prefer not to do?
No, not really.
So I'm just thinking now, what about autopsies on, say, children or little babies? Like, is that something that somebody will say, oh, I can't do that, or I'd prefer not to? Does that happen in the mortuary?
No, not usually. There are people who, or there were people who specialised in those sort of autopsies, and it certainly wasn't my specialty. But no, again, I think that's more a bit of a TV thing. You know, I couldn't possibly do that autopsy because it was a child. Yes, that's more what you see on TV. But again, you know, if it's there to be done, and same as any other autopsy, the information needs to be found, you just go ahead and find it.
I suppose it's like any job, you're able, as we keep talking about, you're able to compartmentalise that this is my job, and you're able to put a lot of the other feelings and emotions aside.
Yes, I think so.
Have you ever experienced a situation where you've conducted an autopsy during the day, and then that evening on TV you've watched a segment on, I don't know, the person that you've conducted the autopsy on? Has that ever happened to you?
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, really? How does that make you feel?
No, it's well, I guess it's more interesting to see what someone else thought was going on, or someone else's interpretation of that particular death.
You're also a specialist advisor and consultant with Forensair, your company, where a law firm may seek your expertise in a homicide or a murder investigation. Can you tell us about when and why a law firm may seek your expertise?
Well, I guess they have a client who says, no, that's not the way it happened, looking at the autopsy report or the coroner's report. So I need someone else's opinion as to how that occurred or what else might have happened. So that's the situation where I get a case like that referred.
And do you get that sort of case a lot? Like, is that common?
No, I've done a few of these sorts of cases, but I'm very much winding down these days now. So,
aren't we all?
Yes.
I understand that. What about giving evidence in court? It's never a pleasant experience, but I'm assuming that you've given a lot of expert evidence many, many times. Have you got a terrible experience in a courtroom that you can share with us, or a good one, something that that's stayed with you?
At first I was very sort of traumatised by going to court.
I bet you
were. I believe the legal profession gave us a very hard time. And I also didn't know very much about our legal system at all, and I don't like being working in ignorance, if you like. So I decided to go back to university and do law. So I did a law degree, and to me that was a whole sort of area opened up, and I realised how these barristers are performing and why they're performing like that, and also the sorts of things that they're doing and how to counteract it. So it was actually a very useful exercise on my part, and now I'm not the slightest bit traumatised by appearing in court.
What's the biggest lesson you learned with your law degree and giving evidence in court? What's the biggest lesson you learned about what barristers will do and how you respond?
Well, the first thing or the biggest thing I think I learned was that they're actually doing what we are taught to do as part of the law degree, which is make the witness look unreliable. If you realise that that's happening, you can develop a few strategies, if you like, to get over that. One thing I learnt was, for example, some barristers would ask questions with multiple negatives and in the question. So at the end, you didn't know whether you were coming or going, or whether the answer should be yes or no.
That is so true.
And I found the easiest thing in that case was to just look a bit blank and say, "Could you repeat the question, please?" And that often worked with that one. But we were actually taught these things in law school as part of our advocacy program, and I found that very interesting. Because once I realised what they were actually doing, it was much easier to counteract.
Mm. But you're right there about when they ask those questions, and there's, you know, about 10 questions in the one, and often you put the pressure back on them by asking if they can repeat it, because it also gives you a little bit of time to think about the answer as well, don't you find?
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but I was always taught the more you say in the witness box, the more fuel you're giving a barrister or a solicitor to have a go at you. And we were always taught to, as much as we can, say yes or no. Because the minute you start trying to justify your yes or your no, you're giving them just more information to, I used to think they were picking on me, but they're not. They're just doing their job. It's just their client, isn't it? It's their client, and their job is to represent that client.
Yes. One of the other things that I learned to do was a barrister will often start with, "I put it to you," and then go on with whatever they're putting to you. And I'll just sit there, stand there. And they say, "Well, doctor," and I say, "What was the question?"
Yes. The law degree was probably one of the best things you did. But I would have thought that you would have had some sort of training as a forensic pathologist, that you would be called to give evidence at court quite a lot. And I'm surprised that you weren't given any, I don't know, court, you know, moot court situations or somewhere where they might sort of teach you a little bit about the tricks of the trade.
That may be the case nowadays, I'm not sure, but certainly not in the days when I was trained, no.
Feel free not to answer the following questions, but I wondered if I could ask your thoughts on a couple of notable cases here in Victoria. And if you don't feel comfortable commenting, please say, but one of them that's really fascinated me is the case of Phoebe, I don't know how you say her name, Handsduk or whatever, but she's a young lady who a coroner found fell feet first 12 floors down a rubbish chute here in, I think it was St Kilda Road. There's been a lot of discussion over the years about the case due to lots of inconsistencies, lots of theories and lots of rumours. And I'm not asking you to comment on the coroner's finding, but do you have any personal thoughts on that case?
I wasn't directly involved with that case, but I was interested in following it. Mm. And
you and me both.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it's extremely unlikely that she fell down the garbage chute, as was described. Mm.
Yes, I followed that with interest too, because for those listeners that aren't aware, Phoebe was, I think, living with the son of a county court judge, was it, Shelley?
No, Supreme Court judge.
Supreme Court judge, yes, yeah. That's right. Yes, and, it was, I would have loved to have known a bit more about that case, but we only know what we hear, so what can we do? And what about your thoughts on the older couple? They've only gone missing in the last 12 months or so in the high country. They've never been found. They had some sort of an alleged affair. And again, there's been lots of rumours about them staging their own deaths, being eaten by wild animals. Do you have any thoughts on that investigation?
Well, that the place from where they were last seen, the Wanangatta Valley, has always fascinated me. In fact, that's probably also partly responsible for me ending up as a forensic pathologist. Mm. When I was a medical student, a doctor who another medical student was working for, doing these placements in our final year of medical school, he decided that he was needed to go for a weekend away, and so he took the student who was working for him, and I was invited to go along too, and we went to this Wanangatta Valley, and because he said it was very interesting and told me the story of the original Wanangatta Valley murders, and I saw what was probably my first a crime scene, if you like, and have been fascinated by it ever since. So I think it's a fascinating place. It's in the middle of absolute nowhere.
Certainly is.
But, yes, I really don't have any strong views on what's happened to these people. I expect that we'll find out eventually, but it may take quite some time.
So seeing, I don't know the place well, but seeing that you obviously do, is it possible that a wild animal could devour a deceased person to the point where there was nothing left behind? Is that possible?
No, I don't think so. I think you've been watching too much TV, Narelle.
No, what I'm actually asking for is not so much for myself but for my listeners, because remembering I don't have a TV, but I know my listeners watch a lot of Silent Witness. They watch a lot of CSI. They watch a lot of crime shows. And I think that would be a question that some people might ask. So what you're saying is you don't believe that a wild animal could do that?
No. They usually leave. Look, animals can leave and insects too can devour a lot of particularly soft tissues, but there's usually bones of some sort left behind. So one would expect to find something, even though there might may well have been animal and insect damage.
Mm-hmm. Actually, while we're on Silent Witness and CSI TV shows, in those TV shows, and I know it's TV, but they seem to have quite a strong relationship with the police. They work very, very closely together. Did you find that in your time with VIFM?
Yes, worked quite closely with the investigating officers, and again, you know, if we found something or we had a question that needed to be answered, it was good to be able to talk to them. Yep.
Yeah, you said you mentioned about Black Saturday, working on Black Saturday. I think that's something that most police working in that, when was that, 2000 and was it 2009?
Possible. I can't remember.
Anyway, whenever it be, but that had an effect on a lot of people, didn't it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Going back to the bodies in the wild, in general terms, would you have any idea how long it'd take for a deceased body to decompose in the wild?
It depends enormously on, where the body actually is. Is it lying in an open plain or beneath trees or beneath rocks or dirt, or enormously variable? And those things need to be established if you're trying to determine the cause of death or the time of death, how long the body's been out there, because, as I said, it's enormously variable.
Yeah, I suppose one would you'd probably a body that is in the freezing cold is going to last a lot longer than a body that's in 41 degree heat.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on Mr. Krull, the abduction and rape of Carmen Chan, and there was another, Nicola Linus. I can't remember the name of the other little girl, Sharon somebody. But do you have any ideas on him?
I do have on Carmen Chan, but which she used to live just around the corner from me. I drive past her house every day. But, yes, and we'd just moved into the region when that occurred, and we were standing at a friend's place one evening after dinner, and all of a sudden there were all these flashing lights and helicopters whirring about, and so I remember that quite distinctly. But I'm not sure that I believe that Mr. Krill was responsible for that murder.
I was going to ask you one more. I'm going to ask you something about an operation that I was involved in. I was the informant for, and it's called Operation Collier. It's an unsolved case where an unidentified male abducted and raped six, I think possibly more, young women in and around the Dandenong Ranges in the 90s. I was going to ask you, in your opinion, is it possible to abduct, rape, and then release a victim and there be no DNA or any other type of trace evidence located on the person? And I only ask that because there's a saying that we were taught at DTS that you would know very well, and that's the saying is every contact leaves its traces. So I'm not being critical of the scientists, but is it the case that something would have been there on one of the victims, but we just weren't able to find it? Is that possible?
Look, I think it's highly likely that there would be traces there. But again, you know, you're saying this was in the 90s. You know, the science is improving all the time, the technology and the things that we're able to ascertain. But it also is a matter of how hard you look and what you look for. But as I said, it's advancing all the time. So it might be different than, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
I'm sure it would be. But also, if we keep, let's say we keep, I don't know, let's say a top or a blanket or something from 15 years ago, they can now find things on that top or that blanket DNA-wise that they wouldn't have had a hope of finding that long ago. That's right, isn't it, from a forensic pathology point of view?
Yes, yes.
That's why you should never throw anything out evidence-wise.
No.
Yeah, I can remember being at the crime squads, and there was a stage where they were trying to get rid of all this property out at McLeod, and we just had this was in the 90s, early 90s, and we had to sign, we've done that, all we can about that investigation, and they got rid of property. Like, when you look back, what a mistake that was. But anyway, they weren't to know, but, yeah, it's why you should always keep it. Well, Shelley, thank you so much for your time today. To say it's been enlightening would be an understatement, but thank you for your insight into a world that not many of us know.
Thanks, Narelle.
Thank you for your time.
It's okay. Enjoyed it.
Hey, it's Narelle here again. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the podcasts as much as we enjoy putting them together. But to make sure you never miss an episode of Narelle Fraser Interviews, hit subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a rating and even a review. And please share it with all your friends too. And again, thanks for joining us. We have got some amazing stories to tell. So thanks again. See ya.